It's too easy to forget that ingredients we rely on today haven't always been here in the U.S., either through import or grown here. And there are always stories embedded deep in everything we ingest. Quinoa in particular has a story that tells far more than the nutrition at the heart of a tiny protein-packed grain. Anthropology professor emerita Linda Seligman relates these stories of the Andean highlands. Hi.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for joining us. Remind us when quinoa first made an appearance here as an import product.
It was really in at the beginning of the 21st century that consumers in the West had recognized that quinoa packs a lot of punch. And they were also very excited about quinoa because it was like a grain, but it was gluten-free. So in 2003, there were about 36 products that used quinoa as an ingredient. And in 2018, there were 267 different quinoa products that were circulating in the West.
When a product that has its home and is exported initially from a relatively small place with a relatively small capacity into a market like the U.S., things can quickly go sideways. Tell us what some of the challenges have been for the Andean farm workers who have been tending this grain for millennia.
There's so many different issues involved within the Andes. And by the way, Peru is the principal exporter of quinoa, followed by Bolivia. Quinoa has been a minor but valued component of the indigenous diet in the Andes. And people there have, over those millennia, adapted it to an extraordinary array of microecological and climatic conditions. They've grown it along with many other food crops that are vital to their subsistence. So the effort to try to market it involved numerous changes in how it was cultivated, what kinds of quinoa were cultivated. And then perhaps one of the most critical issues has been getting it to market and getting it to export. Because the global demand surged so quickly, as you pointed out, people got very excited about growing quinoa, and they had support from paragovernmental and non-governmental organizations in, you know, kickstarting quinoa for the global market. But they tried to narrow it to certain kinds of quinoa. And what you had was not surprising. You had a boom bust in quinoa. So the price surged enormously, and then farmers tried to grow even more of it. And then, of course, the market went bust because there was too much supply. The other thing is more complicated. As I mentioned earlier, quinoa is adapted to all different kinds of microenvironments and also for food and aesthetic purposes within the indigenous economy and people's, you know, households. And by emphasizing only one or two kinds, that has an impact on domestic consumption as well.
Could you get, pardon me for the pun, but could you get a bit more granular about this mixing of different kinds of quinoa and the effects on the indigenous communities?
The mixing is more an aesthetic issue than it is a practical issue. Within the indigenous communities, there are certain kinds of quinoa that are preferred for different foodstuffs. If you make it as a soup, you use one kind of quinoa. If you want to make a kind of beer with it, you use another kind of quinoa. If you want to roast it, you might use yet another kind. But part of the aesthetic involved is that Indigenous people don't want to mix their quinoas. They really are acutely aware that different kinds of quinoa taste differently or work differently for different purposes. And yet in the West, we really haven't thought about it that way. So there are two kind of different forces at work. One is people don't care about mixing. It looks beautiful if you put together black quinoa, red quinoa, pink quinoa, yellow quinoa, white quinoa. And if you go to supermarkets, that's how you often see it displayed. But one key issue that plays a role in the export is the following. Quinoa is really a seed, not a grain, and it acts very much like a grain in most ways. But usually grains can be threshed and then they're used. But in the case of quinoa, surrounding the seed of quinoa is an outer hull that is called saponin. And it's very bitter, and you simply cannot use the quinoa without removing that outer hull. And you know, within Andean communities, this is a very labor-intensive and gendered undertaking. And with some kinds of quinoa, you have to rinse it up to 20 times to get rid of that outer hull. And so to try to scale up for the export market, if you're talking about smaller districts or communities, is extremely challenging. And these development organizations, actually, in the cases I worked with, promised communities a machine that would get rid of that outer hull that was similar to what we call a rice perler. But they never came through. What they did come through was only rinsed very small amounts of quinoa. And so that's a huge issue in getting these products to market.
And what about the pressure on those who have control of these traditional areas where quinoa is grown from other industries, mining in particular?
Well, this is a very interesting and important question. Shortly after I arrived in the district where I worked, the family I stayed with that I had known for almost 40 years said, well, let's go to the quinoa fields. And he was a member of the Quinoa Cultivators Association. And as tired as I was, we went on up into the Puna and up to his quinoa fields. And while I was there, the workers who were helping him with sowing the quinoa were talking quite extensively about gold and about mining. They were having kind of a debate about it, whether it was good or bad or otherwise. Well, this eventually became an enormous issue while I was there, and all sorts of mining concessions have been staked out all over the Andes, including Peru, and quite unbeknownst to communities sometimes, yet in conjunction with the government. So one of the things that was going on was that the district and many of the surrounding provinces get their water from these very high ethereal lakes. And it provides to an enormous area. So it's essential not just for people to have access to water to drink, but also to irrigate their fields and to their livelihoods as farmers. And it turns out that part of this area had already been concessioned for purposes of mining gold and molybdenum and some other very important minerals that pollute. And so this incited eventually a sort of movement to, you know, resist this. So this has a direct link to not only, you know, producing quinoa for the export market, but for the basic livelihoods of people whose actual villages and farming lands may be located many kilometers away from these lakes in question, which are considered sacred as well.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming and talking to us about a grain that most of us pop in our mouths without thinking about the deeper story.
You're welcome.
That was anthropologist Linda Seligman. She's the author of Quinoa, Food Politics and Agrarian Life in the Andean Highlands.
The Market Report is on deck. Stay with us.